No.
Yeah. I mean, just know what you're saying, but also I just think it's not.
Copy that thing to different than people understand.
Because actually, it was like such a big thing going on when they got so worried about it that I went into faculty staff assistance program to get some like customer service training tips, and they issued me a depression test. They're like, everybody walks in the door, that's it's a depression test.
They re-architected the library.
Yeah, they put up the recite stuff, but you can't jump. Yeah, and we canceled the sustainability class for the semester because we weren't allowed to go on the roof. We're still not. So we have to think of non-solar.
They'll have to prove that you're not suicidal.
And it's retarded.
They can't. It's impossible to prove you're not suicidal.
They actually canceled it more, I think, politically, because you didn't have to go on the roof to get the energy, but like the department put the panels up there without the dean's permission, so.
Yeah, we do things like that sometimes, because we're the chief department. So, what I want to do for the next 37 minutes is talk about some examples in real life. We can relate them back to techniques that we see in the book. You all read the section, so we don't have to go over it, right? About how this sort of big group thing works, you know, to unify the group, and create some purpose, get people to take an oath and all that, and how that plays out, because you'll see that same shape again and again and again.
Can we talk about cognitive dissonance?
What about it?
I don't know, that's what always fascinated me about most about a cult, is this thing like, you know, like you have these cults and then like when they get really crazy, the leader predicts that the world's gonna end, like, you know, 3 years or whatever. And like the world never ends. But what's really interesting is that it doesn't destroy the cult at all. It actually makes them stronger because, like, people have been so committed to this belief system, like, oh, the world's going to end on, you know.
Well, great. How do Jehovah's Witnesses deal with it? The world already ended, according to them. It happened. And now we're in the sort of the aftermath of it.
I mean, the basic psychological thing going on is that people are so committed to this idea that if it doesn't happen, they can't just be like, oh, we were wrong. They have to come up with an excuse for it.
Right. I mean, it's one of the great reasons why cult leaders have sex with their followers, so many of them, because it's really hard to justify then that the cult leader is just a cult leader if you've had sex with them already. Because then you have to... You have to reverse engineer your commitments. That's the way the cognitive dissonance works. It's sort of like the undertow on a beach. It's really stronger than any overt pressure. I mean, nothing against here, but it's the same thing that happens here. If you're paying, I don't know how many of you are paying, but if you're paying, what does it cost? Before housing,
yeah.
To be here.
Yeah.
Like, if you're paying that kind of money, if you didn't believe it before, you've got to believe it after, that it's worth that, right?
I'm sequestering myself.
Yeah.
because I have student loans. So
yeah,
at the end of the day, I'm going to end up paying like...
Well, this class is $7,000.
Yeah, but everybody else is doing it, right?
Yeah.
But so that's something really important. Make it worthwhile.
Your time with me is worthwhile as time can be. Just mere exposure is all you need. We can sit silently in a room. But the fact is, once you're already doing something that is outrageous, right? Like, let's say 97, let's say it was 70,000, right? The more familiar this looked, the less it would seem worth $70,000. If you paid $70,000 for just this class, then it almost would make more sense that we did sit down there, because you have to believe that it's, you know what I mean, that much weirder. I'll tell you cognitive dissonance. This is supposed to be secret. Relative of mine, right now, dying of adult leukemia, and she's gone to psychics all her life, and all the psychics said she would live a really long time, and all the psychics she's gone to since she got this have said, oh no, it's not going to be bad, it's going to get better now, it's going to get better then, it's going to get better. They've all been wrong. What she said to me on the phone the other day was, I'm trying to figure out how it is that I block the psychics from being able to see me. The best psychics in the world have failed at seeing me. So she would rather believe that she is blocking the psychics, that she's the aberration and the psychics are all right, than that maybe all the psychic healers are wrong. I mean, that's...
How could all of them be wrong, right?
Because how could all of them be wrong? The only way they could all be wrong is if she has the problem. She has the block to their energy. That's pure... that's right out of the book. That's pure cult mindset. That example isn't in the book, no.
There's one almost exactly the same.
Yeah, well, that, what happens? I mean, everybody I talk to in cults at one point or another has doubt. And the thing then that keeps them from expressing doubt is that there's people lower than them in the pyramid. And that's why I describe pyramid schemes and cults the same place. Because a real cult, you do want to move closer and closer to whatever the cult leader, the guru at the center of it, or the money, or the thing, or the achievement. Even Scientology, it's very hierarchical as you move in and get more clear. Are you feeling more clear since you're...
Oh, absolutely. I've gone to the 42nd Street Times Square to get my stress test.
Oh, good.
So there's a sense of responsibility that also wraps you up. And
well, not wanting to... Of
the structure, right. Oh, so are you saying it's more of a ego thing or more of a duty thing?
I think it's a duty thing, and you're going to start slipping. If you show doubt to someone lower than yourself in the pyramid, then you go lower than that person in the pyramid, right? Mm-hmm. The whole pyramid works by faith in Mary Kay, as it were. It's how gung-ho you are. And if you've got a voice doubt, then you're obviously not ready for the next level. So you get Tom Cruise going on TV saying, I believe, I'm here, I commit. You know, the more...
Actually, he's crazy.
Well, he pushed it, didn't he? I'll be interested to see if they abandoned him.
The Scientologists? Or his public relations. Oh,
they have their own cognitive dissonance, too. Like, they put so much in Tom Cruise, they can't give up faith now, right?
They're pretty quiet, though, aren't they?
I don't know. They didn't really back him after he said that. I didn't hear quotes about Scientologists being like, "You support Tom's rash statement." Everyone just kind of said, "I hope Mr. and Mrs. Smith still does well."
I mean, if he comes out or anything, they're gonna drop one and have to take
that. He said that, you know, I think he said a bunch of things, but amongst others, Brooke Shields took postnatal depression, anti-depression pills and stuff, and he was just kind of going off about how, you know, mothers need to go natural, and you know, she's really not making any smart decisions.
Well,
and
he also said I'm looking at her career.
Oh, did that?
Yeah. He was like,
she has a sitcom, she's fine.
She's in Chicago.
She's married to Agassi for a while.
No?
I'm always interested in that too, annulment versus divorce. Divorce means you were married, annulment means you never really were.
Yeah. They were in a state of confusion when they got married. And then
so it doesn't count. God bless. But I thought we could share, so we're not just dealing with things I've seen or researched, experiences people have had. The coercive group, subscription or cult in which you come in contact.
I believe no one's heard of Market America. That really boggles my mind.
But you come in contact with them. Where are you from?
Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Maybe they're bigger there than here. These things don't work as well on the coast as they do.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Children International, that company that gets you to sponsor kids, and then they always send you, you know, it's like $15 a month or something, and then after a while, they bump up their, you know, now it's $17 a month, and buy this kid a birthday present, and do this, and do this. Yeah, they send you stuff all the time, occasionally pictures.
Are
occasionally.
You giving the kid a birthday present, or is it bullshit?
If you send them more money, then yeah, I guess they would. I don't know what, or they, you know, get some more food.
They send them a card. They send them a card asking for $5, you know?
Yeah, it's like, you know, okay, he needs these shots now and this and that. You know, they come up with every single reason for you to give them more money. I think maybe 80% goes to the kids.
Saying your money might not go directly to them.
Yeah, I don't know all the exact details. Hopefully, it's going to someone.
Well, I mean, what was that about? The person who came up with that.
It's going to someone.
Let's personalize the experience of charity. So instead of just giving to a mass of starving children, you're giving to purple.
And here's a picture. Yeah.
But are they sending the same picture?
No. They have a packet for each kid, and then like, okay, they pick out. Here's one from India, and her name is Princess. Blah blah blah. You get a letter from them occasionally that has a couple words and number two pencil.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for my shot.
Exactly. My bread today was good, thank you. Yeah.
I experienced something with a coercive group that I wanted to share, but the thing is, it's a con essentially, but it's more like viral media that we were talking about. It was a small fair. Happening like a street fair, and there was a guy, a very entertaining guy, with a bunch of people around him, and I think it was a buck. And what you got to do is you sat down, you know, like the almost like the portable massage chairs you sit in, the ones that are kind of weird. You like it was something similar to that. You just sat in it, and it was like the whole thing he was advertising was like natural LSD, right, or the natural LSD effect. And what it is, you sit in this chair and they put on these glasses, and all you have to do is just like look towards the light, and then you like turn it on, and it was like, you know. And so I'm standing around like watching these people, and it was like really, it was a buck for one. And for two, for just one little, you know, you
get like one hit, seconds of one tab.
But people were like, whoa, dude, like they were standing up, there's like, oh my god, this one woman's like, I've never seen anything like that. I was like, whoa, this is crazy shit, I gotta try this. And so I sat down.
Did they wear plants?
Well, no. And this is like a true story, okay? Because it doesn't seem like this would happen to me, but I sat down and put the glasses on and like did something and they spun. And it was like a kaleidoscope, you know, it was like colors and light. And
it cost $10.
But there were people right here, like, whoa. And there were people like here, like, whoa. And it was this little stage almost that you sat down and all the crowd was watching. And when he took off the glasses, he was like, how did it feel? And I was like, awesome. And you know, he was like, how was it? And I was like, awesome. And he was like, was that cool? And I was like, yeah, really? Colors? And everyone was like, no way. And the other guy ran up and went to do it. And I kind of walked away and I was like, I'm such a chump. No, it was just like, literally, it was like, I didn't want to say, I don't really get it. You know, I felt like, I didn't want to say, I don't think I get it.
Well, it's the same when you see those healing
brain. Yeah, what about this? Like, has anyone ever gone to a psychic show? Like
that's the worst, because if you don't act like an idiot, you are like the bummer.
Well, we would go in high school, we'd go like, I don't know, it was just like a show, and everyone would go, it was at Tony Roma's.
They're free, aren't they?
They're free, but then you have to buy drinks or something, right. Like two cokes, because we're in high school. But I never went on stage, but I was always like really fascinated with the way people acted, and really curious, like, if it was real or not, you know?
Because they set it up in such a way that if you don't, you're not giving in to, you're not relaxing enough to let yourself be in a natural state.
Yeah.
So it's like, you're, if you don't act like a fool, then you're repressed.
They pre-select.
But the more important thing, I think, is what they do to the audience. So they gradually ratchet it up. So by the end, the audience is in absolute hysterics and laughter and screaming.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, I've only ever been in the audience, but I've, that's one of the only times I've been like, I'm not acting like myself now. I don't think I was hypnotized.
So
all of the, I was about 18, and all the kids into such a frenzy of like hysterical laughter. In fact, I must have had an effect on the people on the stage. Because they were in front of these people, they were all like crying with laughter and shouting at them. Like, you know.
Apparently, it has more effect on the audience, though, than the people on the stage. People on the stage, you know, may walk for a minute and then, you know, crumble in the back or something. But everyone in the, from witnessing that, you know, you witness a little child who's blind and can see or something, you know, it's all for the group.
Yeah.
Because the way they make their money is the group giving their dollars. I see someone who has a pain in their side, you know? It's a thousand of them are like, oh my God, it's me. I know someone who has a relative who's ill. Oh, 90% hit right there.
I have a friend who went to a psychic, like, Lee's village. She just stopped in. I guess she's gone before, not to this person. But the woman started to tell her some things that made her believe that this woman had some psychic power or whatever, or ability. And so they started talking, and she said they were talking for about 2 hours. And the woman said, like, there's something that I have to tell you. She said, you've lived like 9 times, this is your 10th life, but the spirits wouldn't let you live because of what happened to you. And she's like, what happened to me? And she said, like, you were married to a guy that was a child molester and you gouged his eyes out, and you're going to die at your 33rd birthday. And she was 32 at the time.
What?
And she, right. And it's totally unbelievable that this happened to her, but it happened to her. And she said, and there's no way that I can take money from you for telling you this. You know, she's like, the spirits brought you to me so that I could heal you. And, like, after 2 hours, everything's kind of light conversation, you know, and then it takes this terrible turn. And she said, and Abraham's like, well, you know, how do you heal me? And the woman said, well, you have to buy these stones. And she said, well, how much are the stones? And the woman said, $8,000. But I can get them for you for like $6,000 or something. And my friend left, and she's like, there's no way that I can pay this to you. And when she left, but she was deeply affected by having, like, this person tell her that, like, she gouged this person's eyes out, and she was married to this child molester. I mean, like,
she was an unpop.
And that was after an hour or two of totally preparing the field.
That's horrible.
And she was deeply, deeply, and understandably, deeply affected by it. And she wasn't ever going to fork out the $6,000, but, I mean...
Is she 34 now?
She's actually 33.
Well, she hit her birthday, right?
Is she still alive? Is she at home?
What's that?
Is she at home?
Is she at home?
Yeah, so nothing happens to her?
But yeah, she won't be in the apartment. She's fine, but, I mean, you know, she had to go to some alternative healers after that, like, just to clear it out of her system. But, I mean, that's definitely the worst thing I've ever heard. I'm like, you should go to the police. Like that's horrible.
No, that's like extortion.
I went to an actual cult once.
You were in one?
Not, I didn't join. No, but I was like, yeah, no 6,000. No, I was in high school, and I grew up to, like, Morningside Heights, and I think they didn't know I was underage. I think they were going for the Columbia kids around there, but it was like the Moonies were on the street, and I was like, well, let me see what the hell this thing is about. I mean, I knew it was more like investigating. You know, I didn't want to join the Moonies, but I was like, all right, let's see what they're doing. Like, how do they play this game? And they took me to this, like, brownstone on 108th Street. And you walk in, and, like, I forgot their patter, but, like, the thing I noticed the most was the, like, you know, they started just bringing you deeper and deeper in, like, to this building. And all of a sudden, I'm like, wait, there's, like, a wall of people behind me, like, blocking it. And at a certain point, I decided, all right, this is enough. I'm far enough into this place. Like, how do I get out? And, you know, that's, like, I turn around, and there's, like, there's no door left anymore. There's like people over, you know, and like they're constantly positioning themselves to stop you from leaving. They want you to go upstairs, right? It's like, oh, I think I want to go this way. And it took me like 15 minutes to like just speak and step my way around them back to the door. It was like, how do I get out of this place now?
Yeah, they're a little more coercive in their methodology than other cults, which are sort of more subtle. We used to go to the Hare Krishna. I don't know if they still do it. They used to get free Indian food.
Yeah.
Indian food, just for food.
Such a great way to get a free meal.
But these guys, but Krishna's wearing toupees, come, because they all shave their head, you know, get the beanie hair. But these guys wearing toupees would come, go, hey guys, cool food, huh? You know? This all fake, you know, like their cool young people lingo thing. But they were very gentle. I mean, Krishna, they're really, in some ways, not a cult. I mean, they count as one, but they're totally passive in their indoctrination, and they just sit there. It's almost like it's as if it's with this total acceptance, whatever you want to be ready on, and food and music, a little ecstasy. But it's all like, it all feels passive in a certain way. It's just here having a good time. It's not like that flip. I don't know where, I couldn't go far enough, I guess, to see where does the flip happen when the commitment's required. When does that, when does the tug?
It's like the anti-tug. But then how do they have hardcore bands? That's what I can never figure out. Like, there's so many, like in New York at least, there were so many Hare Krishna hardcore bands. It was like...
It was attached to the...
You still... I saw like...
The tail end of like the straight edge
movement. Yeah.
And the vegetarianism.
Yeah.
And you embody both of those things in something that wasn't like a cool thing.
I still saw, in Montreal, I was up there like last year, and there's still like Hare Krishna, like hardcore kids, and they, you know.
I wrote about one, I don't know, it was a real estate pitch, but same difference.
They are intense. I don't know if they're friends. We're in Hawaii.
Timeshares, for people who don't know, is like you kind of buy a condo.
It's a co-op, right?
Yeah, but with a bunch of other people.
They would give you like free meal vouchers, but like a lot. Like you get $150 worth of meal vouchers if you go to like their pitch.
They send you a postcard saying free television or free microwave oven if you just come eat one.
This was like free meal vouchers, and we're like, oh, we're totally going to go because that way we can eat for free for the rest of the week, right? So we went, and she almost bought. I had to pull her out of there. I was like, we are leaving. What are you talking about? Like, the guy comes over, and they show you this video, and then, you know, and they keep you there. They feed you. They give you sandwiches. The place that you go is really nice. You're in a tropical paradise anyway. They have, like, big, beautiful pictures and stuff. Other people are buying. There's, like, open negotiations going on, tables around you. And, you know, it's a little like the buying a car thing where the guy has to go in the back and ask the manager questions. And, you know, well, and first he shows you the deal, and he shows you the special deal that they're having just for that day, but you have to decide that day. And then, you know, you say, no, you don't want to do that. And then he shows you the real special pricing, you know, like the floor keeps dropping and dropping. But she almost did it. And I was like, are you nuts? It's like a, you know, 4-year commitment or something and thousands of dollars. And I'm like, we're out of here. But she really, like, it almost happened.
Did you get
to know that? Yeah, we got many offers.
But you eat while you're being sold to. It's not like you...
No, you leave and then you can go to one of like 20 restaurants and we have vouchers.
They were selling, I've been trying to find the place, I can't remember what they're called, but they sell like culinary supplies. And while they're showing you all these things, they're baking things for you with these tools.
Oh, right.
And I probably wouldn't have gone, but I ended up going to a friend of mine hosting it because she was thinking of getting into it. And the guy who was selling it was like flaming, he was gay, which was kind of funny, just because they realized so many culinary things were so phallic. But he's like very passive sell on me. Oh, you know, you can be a salesperson for this. But, you know, he started his spiel saying, oh, you know, I was a business manager, and I was making X amount of dollars, and now I've made, like, he gave us hard numbers, and he was showing off, like, figures of his tax returns or something like that. This is how much I made this year, and I'm the regional manager now, and, you know, and it was just a big pitch of, and it was kind of two-way, either you could, you know, sell for him, or you could just buy products, and then once it was all done, it was like, oh, look, we've got this nice, you know, spinach dip for you to try, and, you know, like, all these other...
Did your friend buy?
Oh, I bought some stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, it's funny because my wife's family, like, they bought products from that before. They haven't done the sales stuff, but they're actually, I mean, they're decent. They're relatively priced, so, you know. Like, I've got a pizza stand at home from them.
What about from the other side? Has anybody felt that they've ever been part of a group that's, or spoken on behalf of a group?
Oh, yeah.
Trying to get a convert?
Yeah, I'm trying to talk to African-American men aged 60 and over to get a flu shot.
What?
A flu shot.
A flu shot?
Yeah, because there's a lot of resistance, particularly in that community.
Well, I mean, that's certainly one, hand-to-hand, one-on-one. Do you feel you're using any techniques beyond that which you would readily disclose to your targets?
Well, I mean, I don't. I mean, what I'm trying to accomplish is a good means. So
yeah, but
I'm at good ends. So I feel like.
But are you using means?
Well, I think some of the stuff we do is a little sneaky. For example, we're trying to get people away from the idea of the flu, because people misconceive the flu. Like you might say, oh, I have a stomach flu, whereas there's no such thing as a stomach flu. You know, flu? No, there's stomach bacteria and whatnot. The flu is a very particular, very violent virus that. The older you get, the more it can kill you. So we're calling it influenza because that sounds scarier. We're trying to change the whole attitude.
You're rebranding the flu.
We're rebranding the flu. And so I wouldn't necessarily tell my target.
But it's fact-based.
It's all fact-based.
You're trying to be more accurate to its attributes. You're not telling people, get a flu shot and girls will like you more.
No, it's true. No. We're saying all real things, I guess. But it's still like, you know... I think there's a difference, you know. I have no guilt because, again,
right.
I believe in what
but
I'm doing.
No.
But you don't have to put up, I don't think this stuff is as transparent as the target might think, you know, like these bad ads, even the bad ads, I think, have a lot of thought, and outreach programs have a lot of, like, kind of manipulative thought.
Well, I mean, are you honest?
Talking to other people about going here, right? Once you pony up your money and you're done, you have a vested interest in this institution having good reputation and good profile. So once you graduate from here, it's in your best interest to get other smart people to come here, right? Or is it just you've gotten the information you need and it doesn't matter that you went here at all? I mean, in theory, part of the investment...
You've gone here when it was good. Yeah. Or if it had a better reputation, you need to
Right. But you do. I mean, you can't help it, right? On a certain level, you're innocent. You just can't. You just want to get your classes,
that
and then you'll go and stay quiet.
Like that, but when I was asked this class, if I recommend going to ICT, I didn't say yes. I didn't do the right.
What did you say?
I wasn't convincing people to go. Like, I was asked by, like, tertiary students that are not going to be, they should have it.
And you didn't say no? You said no? And
they
can't anyway?
I said they have to do that because they don't have to do
it. Does that change your relationship to your how you feel about being here? In other words, when you get asked, if you don't have to answer the question at all, you can sort of go along and do your work, and then if someone's like, do you think it's worth it? What you're paying, or do you think it's worth the time?
It's worth it, not necessarily because of the courses, and because of what actually just because it's experience and things you grew up and making people. It's not.
But to stop and think, what I'm asking is, does having to stop and think, is it worth it? Does that itself pull you out of the experience and make it worse in a way? In other words, you know what I mean? There's certain things you can do. Certain things you want to pull yourself out of just to go, wow. In other words, oh, I'm in the White House. Oh, I'm fucking a supermodel. Or, oh, basically, fucking a supermodel is no different from fucking a regular person unless you pull yourself out and go, I'm fucking a supermodel. Right?
Totally.
So close, I mean, they're just little sticks, right? But a lot of times, if you pull yourself out enough to evaluate or to be forced to talk about it, if you say great things, it can make you feel, I mean, that's why when you're talking about your religion, oh, I found Jesus and it was 3 years ago and it was great, and then I ended up. You go there, if you go, you know, I found Jesus and then for a couple of years I felt like I didn't know who he was anymore. And I guess I'm doing good works and it's okay, but you know, this church is actually kind of smelly. You know, the priests are trying to get you. And it's good and bad.
So I didn't feel like I was being dishonest in any way, but in retrospect, it felt a lot like evangelizing about something.
Yeah, it's interesting. And even if you don't like it, though, then it's more a question of, like, I've been asked to write for magazines that kind of suck. And then the editor will say, well, yeah, but how do you expect us to get better? You know, if people like you don't come and write for us. You know, or even if here sucks, if I'm a teacher here, and it's like, well, I want it to be better, so I'm going to talk to Clay and try to get into teach here, or Stephen, and get into teach here, and then it is better. You know, but it's both true and a circular logic.
I think that's where culture comes back into it, because, like, I mean, that's what culture is. It's like continuation of belief, right? And, like, you know, there's push culture and, like, you know, sort of saw emergent culture in a way, but, like, you know, what's
continuation of shared belief, you know, like,
yeah.
Ideally, yeah.
It will depend on how good the closing is. You know, if they
just had
to leave, you know, they do a good job
with
the closure.
Well, that's getting you to join some alumni charity. I mean, these alumni, they get money.
I guess you almost have to frame that within the context of being NYU, because I can almost see, like, going out and people going, MPS, what the heck is that? You know, as soon as you mention New York University, then it's, oh, okay. If I were to try and, you know, sell ITP as from a community college that's charging, you know, what, $60,000 a semester or whatever, you know, it's like, I don't know that. So.
Although, interestingly, the thesis presentation at the end serves a multiplicity of functions. Not that it was intentionally contrived that way, but if you have to end your experience by basically defending what you did here for the last 2 years, in other words, if it's the culmination of your work, and then you defend it in a supportive atmosphere, that experience will change the way you...
That's the close, like we were talking
that's
about.
That's the close. That's it's going to change the way you understand everything that led up to it.
Well, I'm glad I already told Red what I thought of this program, so. Got that out before the thesis.
Ooh, are you going to share with the class?
It's like, but then you do it with the thesis, and it's like, now you feel different.
Hey, are you going to share it with the congregation, you know, or are you just going to keep it secret?
I'm going to save it for the book. We need to catch in the movies.
I mean, what is indoctrination? But in fact, it's getting your doctorate, right?
What?
How do you get your doctorate?
I
defend your thesis. It's the club, that club you want to be in, right?
It's different here. The thesis here is not. It's hard, you know.
It's not supposed to be. I mean, the idea of this place, the reason why this and CalArts are the only two places I can conceive of teaching, is that the idea is not to indoctrinate people into a system of thought, but rather to allow people to pursue their line of thought and try to actually, and this is why the curriculum core meetings are so interesting, is to figure out in what directions are people trying to go, so what courses can we play, if like students are going, oh, they're all trying to develop now, you know, wireless group apps, okay, let's do a course in wireless group apps to allow them, you know, and who do we know that knows how to do that stuff, so then they can do that. So it's weird, it's the opposite of the way most institutions work. So it's not to try to institutionalize people, but to try to garner resources that will help people develop in the way they want to go. But that's when you want to have a place that's got like 30 super creative people rather than 110, of which 50 are. You know, because then it's like you have to have two kinds of courses. You know, of course, just to kind of satisfy that course thing. I'm all with Red. Accreditation and all that stuff, this is such caca. You know, because that's all becoming part of the thing. We have to be accredited because it's an official master's, but accreditation actually stands in the way of a place like this being able to do exactly what it wants to do. Because you've got to have these ducks in a row. So if someone comes in knowing, I don't need HTML, I don't want to know that. So, you know, you've got to have this base.
So would you have people going to this school without learning how to code, for example? Say, do you accept people who don't want to deal with technology at all and just want to investigate it on a metaphysical level? Is that something that would be good for the school?
I would think a certain, not this program, but a certain kind of program that would be smaller and that wouldn't worry about accreditation, but just give some kind of certificate after being here for 2 years, could accept a pure philosopher who could be here and for 2 years write philosophy or write a novel or write a thing based on interacting. I mean, like Doug Copeland wrote Microservice after spending like a year on Microsoft campus pretty much and rewired people. That was a worthy pursuit. But you know, you've got to, if you're gonna be in an institution this big, and that's institution for it, you've got to have a mandate. What does this place do that the other, there's like five other computer type departments in this university. I mean, that I haven't even been to. One of them got defunded, I think, last year. But which one? C? Was it C something? Yeah, that got delisted.
Center for Advanced Digital Applications is part of the school continuing professional center for the current master's degree. They're like, they had the biggest schmuck running that place out of Singapore.
And that's a big schmuck. Because I'm sure you've seen many a schmuck.
Oh, yeah.
But belonging, belonging and having a stake in a group, it's going to make your bias, unless you're kind of the revolutionary kind, which all groups should have room for. It's going to, in most people, make your bias towards promoting a group. Because now you have a stake in it. So almost the first thing you want to do to a, I mean, when you buy a certain kind of car or a certain kind of cell phone, you want to be friends and supportive of the other people who have that brand of thing when it's been a real commitment, right?
I came in contact with like the Nike sneaker cult people like last week, which is just, it's frightening. I met somebody who, I mean, he's like one person on the protocol, and he has 17 pairs of Nikes, which he won't wear, which he paid at least $600 for.
Well, go to that place on Green Street. It's like right around the corner. It's like the sneaker temple. It's like a consignment shop, and sneaker. They have $2,000 Nikes in there and shit.
That are new?
No, they're
like special used Nikes.
Like, well, they're older. They're vintage. Like they came out last year, right? And they only made six of them. It's right. It's called like Flight Path or something. It's on Green between, like right off 8th Street.
Why is that called? I don't understand. If there's a bunch of people who decide to collect Nikes and they're selling the value, it's just like, you know, the same thing as any other currency that you decide to collect.
But actually, I mean, I just thought they were kind of ridiculous until I was reading the definition of the cult and kind of actually, like, the people I talked to had actually fit into every single stage of the
definition. Well, the thing is, well, because they've been into it, and I think the thing that would make it so is that you're buying more Nikes, not just to have more Nikes, but to actually move up in a social order that's defined by your Nike.
What about an art collector?
What?
They can't, art collectors, they can be cultish. They can be.
I mean, cultish. Aren't they scared that they're, I mean, if it's a piece of art, sometimes it looks like a piece of shit, so everybody else has to say that it's worth something.
Well, a big story that will not show up in the news is 4 years ago, an estate sale happened at which a Jasper Johns painting